Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily French Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you doing, sir?
I'm good on yourself, Nick.
Hot. I was very relieved when we had some nice rain in Joburg last night. It didn't last. And we are also joined by Ms. Saragon. Sara, are you also suffering under the heat as I am?
I am a little. I'm tending to drop into the swimming pool on a frequent basis.
It's a very good idea. Anyway, let us get into the news of the day. So a bit of a slow day today, but we found some interesting things to talk about nonetheless. The first is a point that the Institute of Race Relations has been making for a long time in a lot of our presentations and in our sort of flagship piece of research, the South Africa Survey. And this is a point that goes back to 1994, and that is the ratio of police to private security guards. So in 1994, at the beginning of the Democratic South Africa, there were, roughly speaking, the same number of policemen as there were security guards. Now, over the last 20, 25 years or whatever, that number has changed quite significantly. In fact, the number of police officers has remained a little bit increased, but remained roughly the same. It's now at 182,126, and 21,000 of those are commissioned officers, 122,000 are non-commissioned officers, and 37,000 are Public Service Act employees. There are about 564,000, so not quite, but close to five times as many security officers who are currently actively employed between 11,300 security companies around the country. So what's all that's happened? And if you take the total number of security guards who are registered across the country, although not all of them are working, there's about 2.4 million of them. So the number of people in the private security force absolutely dwarfs the number of police. And this is really fascinating, and perhaps explains why the ANC has been so paranoid and has recently been pushing forward legislation that will, for example, prevent foreigners from being able to own the majority of security companies. Terence, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, this is a point we've been making for a long time, but I see now people in the media are starting to report it as well. What are the implications of such an enormous expansion of the private security sector?
Well, it says a lot about the way that South Africans perceive their lack of security. And I think also the lack of confidence in the ability of the state to provide for it. In fact, I was just speaking just before this broadcast to a senior figure in organized agriculture. And I was told that this is a major strategic problem for farming communities, that they just, you know, we have a police service that is either unwilling or in many instances unable to do its job. You know, we tend to focus on things like on violent crimes because they get a very visceral reaction. But if you factor in the damage that things like vandalism or theft or even, you know, minor pilfering inflicts on an economy, it's absolutely debilitating. You know, put it like this, you know, for a farmer, and farming is a sector I know quite well, to have a cow stolen, you know, is equivalent to, or in many cases will far exceed what a middle-class suburbanite will pay in a monthly bond. You know, that's the scale of what you're dealing with. I think it does bear mentioning that those 2.4 million security guards, it covers a very wide range of things. They're not all sort of G-men with assault rifles, but yes, this must be South Africa must be an outlier across the world. If you go to a more developed country, or you know, even to developing countries in Asia, which I also have some experience with, private security does things like kind of man access points at in apartment complexes, or they, you know, stroll around malls. Anyone who's seen the Kevin James Fast comedy Mall Cop would appreciate that. These are things that that give a sense of security in what I suppose criminals would regard as target-rich environments. You know, here they're an absolutely key part of your survival strategy. I think what we're seeing with the legislation is typical ideology and paranoia override pragmatism and good sense.
So it's interesting to me that as the government has really attempted to kind of clamp down its control over society, particularly over law and order, and we see this in things like, for example, trying to remove self-defense from the reason to own a firearm, that at the same time, they've accidentally sort of privatized law and order in South Africa in many ways. Sarah, what do you make of this issue?
The paranoia certainly does explain the desire to limit ownership of private security. And as you say, you know, security can be anything from the guys who ride shotgun carrying cash around and whose lives often are at real risk, to a guy just keeping an eye on a building, being employed to keep an eye on what's going on in a building. So it's, as you say, it's wide-ranging. In reality, the Minister of Law and Order shouldn't actually, or law, whatever, police, you should in a way be relieved, because the crime problem has become so huge that the police are struggling to do what they, the role that is specifically allocated to them. In other words, no one can investigate crime other than the police. Unless you hire a private investigator. So the maintaining security and preventing these things from happening, particularly in the ideological ineptness that we face, in a way, the police should be relieved. And when you bear in mind that for the last 2 years, there has been absolutely no new intake into the police. There's been infighting between the various most senior levels of management in the police, which is, I mean, I think you've seen a combination of internecine fighting and incompetence and ineptness. It's actually quite absurd. I mean, I had an example the other day of a young woman who was running through a suburb she lives in, and some guy, probably a little crazy, sort of accosted her and threw her to the ground and started kicking her. And she got away. She went to the police station. I would have thought fairly straightforward and probably not difficult to find the guy. And they just sort of said, you know, whatever, we're not going to, you know, we don't do. And I think it's now reached the stage of an inertia where we almost are required to discount the police as a presence at all. And so I think if any attempt, well, I should hope that any attempt to affect the private security industry by sort of stamping the authority of the Ministry of Police and which it cannot handle anyway, should be met with outrage.
Terence, any final thoughts on this topic before we move on to the next one?
No, I can't really add much to that. I do know that survey after survey of people's opinions, and yes, there are people who will, you know, shout bloody murder if I mention a survey. But this is not just our own, and this goes back to the 1990s. Have found that security, people's physical security, the security of their property, is something South Africans desperately want. In fact, the idea of an orderly society And it's something that that successive governments have promised. In fact, I remember the headline from about 2000, gloves off in search of in pursuit of an orderly society. Those gloves may have come off, but there were just these little kitten paws underneath them. But yeah, you know, and we have the surreal situation where a state that aspires to micromanage every aspect of your life can't reasonably guarantee you the one basic thing, which is to be alive the next day.
Can I just add a point that not taken into account, like so many things in the society, private security is an after tax expense, and it's not just the expense of the security, but it's in the expense of security measures that people feel they need to take around their home. Those add up considerably, and it's almost like the police system is pickled in aspic. It's just missing in action or non-action.
So, if I could just add something on top of that, I've traveled a good part of the world, and I've been to countries that are much poorer. The sense of personal dread that you feel. I mean, I've walked, you know, through Lusaka at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, amongst the revelers, and there was never a hint of a threat. Done the same in Dar es Salaam, although the nightlife wasn't as good. In Taipei, a housebreaking will make news headlines. God, what is the country coming to? And I'm telling you, the only reason people burgle houses there is for the thrill of it, because the electronic goods they steal are so cheap that you really don't want a second-hand one. But yeah, life is cheap and security is compromised.
Yeah, unfortunately so. But it's an interesting, I think, thing to remember about all of the plans for state controls, just as you say, is all these vast ideas about reshaping society, and then right underneath the government's nose, law and order has become the domain of the private sector in many ways. Anyway, all right, let us move on to our next story. Sara, there is a big battle to be fought at UCT, or there might be, over the renaming of various things. So, of course, UCT keeps making headlines. This is the University of Cape Town. Over the years, they famously had the Rose Must Fall statue stuff going on. But now there's yet to be another battle over the names of things and the importance of symbols and that kind of stuff. What's going on at UCT, Sara?
Well, UCT's come under a lot of attack in the last few years for the way it's changed. It's moved to a greater level of wokeness and deteriorating standards. And there has been a move to change the names of buildings and sites to more properly reflect the South African zeitgeist, which one partly understands. I mean, some of the names have a distinctly colonialist feel. Others do not, but I'm not entirely sure that either the authorities or the student body know anything about the people whose names are attached to those sites. But what did amuse me is that there was a notification put out, a sort of general notice from the Vice Chancellor Mamohetsi Pakeng, and that one of the things they want to rename is the plinth. Now that almost has a Monty Python-esque quality about it. This was the plinth upon which Rhodes statue was based originally.
Right. So it's just a piece of stone. It's like a column.
It's a sort of slightly pyramidal shape thing that's flat on top, that the last time I saw it had a plastic chair sitting on it, which perhaps is more potent a symbol than anything else. And I think what they'll have is they have a naming committee that makes a recommendation to the council, and the council seems to accept the naming committee's recommendations, and they get input from everyone in the university who wants to make an input. But really, this begs for some sort of humor, like Pliny the Plinth. I don't know. It's just quite absurd. They, more controversially, but nevertheless, they decided to rename Smuts Hall, which is a residence named after Jan Smuts. And whatever his negatives were he was a genuine statesman nationally and internationally, but they felt they had to rename it. But because they weren't ready to give it a name, but it might, you know, you didn't want them to hurt people's feelings and oppress them any further. In the interim, it's called the Upper Campus Residence. Now, to my mind, this is just playing the fool and messing around with a certain concern about being hurt by colonial, neo-colonial influences that I think is just really not there. A couple of more months being called Smut Hall, you know, people would have survived to live another day. And the other area they want to rename is Jammy Plaza, which is the area outside what was Jamison Hall and is now the Sarah Bartman Hall. You know, it's the main edifice standing in front of, against the mountain. Very impressive. There's only one problem. It's not called the Jamison Plaza or the or Jammy Plaza. It's what it's a name people use to refer to it geographically. In other words, I'll meet you for a zol at Jammy Plaza. It's not a place as such. It doesn't need to be a place. But I suppose the problem is you can't call it Jammy Plaza and have Sarah Bartman Hall in the background. So I'm sure it'll be named after some worthy, but, you know, to add to the sort of concentrating on things that don't matter enough, we have a vice chancellor who sort of sees her students as her sort of broadly as her children, and she goes into the library where they're studying to hand out chocolates to see that they're doing, you know, they're surviving the pressures of exams. And all I can think of is, you know, this isn't nursery school. This is university. These people have to become adults. Very nice, but, you know, that's not her role. It may be a bit harsh, but they can buy their own chocolates.
So, once again, we're sort of being dragged into this kind of very sort of esoteric, emotional debate over symbols. And these things always just strike me as kind of weird. Because the fight almost always seems to be started by someone who's basically a professional activist at some point, and then it becomes some huge emotive touch point and everyone is fighting each other and damning each other as racists or idiots or whatever. And I get the sense, as our friend Big Daddy Liberty sometimes says, that we're being dribbled here, that this is almost like a distraction from things that are important. Terrence, what do you make of all this?
Well, if you want some comedy, I'm reminded of the Goon Show. There was an episode where the city council was going to cut down a tree. I said, why? Well, when they walk past in the morning, there it is, defying them. I think this is pretty much what you see here with the plinth, which Sora helpfully said is now
a comedy. Maybe they should call it Plinthy Mac Plinthface.
Actually, I had a most serious name for it. Sorry to interrupt. Maybe they should, to reinvigorate free speech and debate on campus, which has become a significant problem at UCT, is they should call it the Hyde Park Plinth. And people should get on top of it and put forward a view, and then someone can get up back on top of it and put forward another view. So maybe, you know, call it the Hyde Park Plinth.
Sorry, I think you're missing the whole point about where this is all going. The idea that you're going to have sort of free speech zones, or, you know, say what you want, I think pushes very much against the zeitgeist. I think that I wrote an extended article about this some time ago, looking at Africa as a whole, generally speaking, those colonial monuments, you know, often sort of give way. The real fun happens after the first or second liberation generations go, and then they want to like pull down all the stuff that's been put up there, because, you know, the population takes a look around and says, you know, what scoundrels these people were. In fact, I think the Ghanaians had got it right when Kwame Nkrumah he built this sort of monument to himself when he was overthrown. The crowd in Accra pulled this thing down and decapitated it, but someone must have been awake at the wheel and sort of took and put it in storage. Then after they sort of thought, well, you know, while Nkrumah was flawed and, you know, the guys who took over were scoundrels and rogues and whatever, what do we do with the statue? So they basically put the statue back up, but with all its damage. So you've got the head sort of like, so, you know, make of that what you will. In Accra, you could see the founding father of Ghana with his head knocked off.
I quite like that, actually. It sort of keeps the history of the country intact in a, you know, really,
but, here's the thing, though. I think that Ghana, you know, learned to become a serious country. You know, they've got massive problems, but they've been economic reformers. They have, made moves to instill something akin to good governance. And this was all kicked off by, another coup leader, Flight Lieutenant Jerry Rawlings, never took his dark glasses off, even when he was inside. But, he came to power spouting blood and thunder Marxism, apparently took one look at the books and said, "Jeez, I can't go on like this." So then he became a kind of model reformer, and I think he died some months ago. But he spent his retirement going around Africa doing things like explaining to people how to work together, which is a great gig if you can get it. But the point is, you know, he actually saw a problem and said, "We got to solve it," as opposed to, "I see a problem, let's give it a new name."
Yeah. I actually just went to look up what Ghana's economic growth is, and past couple of years, it's been pretty much around 6%, except during the pandemic when it only grew 1.5%.
Yeah.
Must be nice.
Look, it's not a model society, but, you know, it's serious.
We would love a 6% growth rate.
We'd love a 3% growth rate.
We'd love a growth rate.
What's the Ghanaians if we can have like 1/6 of these?
and their unemployment rate is somewhere around a quarter of ours, but that's more complicated though, because I think a lot of people are still in subsistence farming. But anyway, right, let's move on to our final story today, and this is one I think we touched on very briefly in the news at the beginning of the week, but it's something worth, I think, sort of reflecting on for. Kind of the weird place we find ourselves in global politics at the moment. So a Chinese tennis star recently publicly accused, her name is, I think it's Peng is her surname, I can't remember her first name, but she accused a former vice premier, Zhang Golai, that he had forced her into sex. Now, he's a senior member of the Chinese Communist Party, and that she'd basically been raped by him. These claims very quickly got rubbed off of social media, and then she disappeared, not being seen since in any public. And her tennis coaches and stuff from outside of China were very concerned about what had happened. They couldn't get a hold of her. She just seemed to disappear, and they were worried for her safety. As the story began to gain traction, the Chinese Global Television News, which is a Chinese state media company, posted a screenshot allegedly of an email that she had then put on her social media accounts, where she basically said, nothing to worry about. However, her bosses and coaches and stuff overseas have started to think that this email reportedly showing that she's still okay and in control of her social media accounts might indeed have been faked to make it look like she was okay, when in fact she's been taken away somewhere. And I think it's another sort of chilling reminder of what the price of dissent can be in China. Obviously, we don't know all the facts, but the thing about China is we never will know all the facts, because it's such a closed and autocratic society. But one of the things that this got me thinking about is sort of why the social justice movement, particularly in the developed world, like in the US and Western Europe, don't say that much about China. I mean, they don't really like China. They talk about it in pretty harsh terms, but it's really not a focus for them, despite the fact that it epitomizes almost everything that they rail against, and the fact that it encompasses, you know, like a fifth of humanity or something within its borders. something that's quite shocking. Sara, what do you make of this story and what I was just talking about there?
Yeah, I'm kind of fascinated that, I mean, this tendency to disappear people has become very apparent in the last few years. Quite high profile people have either sort of disappeared for a period or disappeared total, or people have been arrested. And Hong Kong comes to mind in this respect. And I mean, this is not theoretically, wouldn't be seen necessarily for a retired VP to be accused of a sexual scandal. It would be messy, it would hit the papers, etc. But, you know, it doesn't exactly presage the downfall of the state. But the impression one gets is that anything that attacks the Communist Party is considered a threat to the state, even if it's a disgraced vice president.
Right. Recently, we saw a Chinese billionaire who tweeted a poem that was written like 1,000 years ago, but the poem could be read in context that he was tweeting it to be an attack on Xi Jinping. And he immediately had to basically apologize, retract, and start praising the CCP publicly. It's very scary.
I mean, there's, you know, when you think that China's knocking on America's door as far as becoming the biggest economy in the world, has survived its growth rates, while they aren't what they were at their spectacular best, you know, are sound in global terms. I suppose what you're looking at is a classic case of they are in charge. In fact, you know, they monitor people, the facial recognition. It's fairly terrifying. But that any form of attack, even when, and perhaps particularly when a woman attacks a senior man, I would say they're looking at a sort of group think of misogyny, but the fact that it makes them so paranoid suggests that they you know, I suppose like most autocrats, they're never comfortable in their hold on power. So, you know, fairly innocuous or really in the grander scheme of things, irrelevant claims then become an issue for an attack on the CCP and Xi Jinping himself. And that's the sign of the extent to which whatever they may say about the West or anything else, China is a frightening place, and the freedoms that one takes for granted in the West, outside of China, here cannot be attributed to China, notwithstanding their seemingly solid power. So maybe there are gaps, there are weaknesses that one isn't really privy to that makes these things so important for them to deal with.
Terence, your thoughts before we close off?
Well, the Chinese government is paranoid about any challenge to its authority. I think the big lesson it drew from the Gorbachev era in the Soviet Union was that if you start down that road, you can lose control of it. Now they've reformed, but they have kept an exceptionally tight lid on any sort of dissent. And you know, you can see, even when China was sort of opening up, particularly in its coastal areas in the 90s and whatever, where you go and you know go to nightclubs and you'd have celebrities going there, and you could watch CNN in your hotel. You know, they would, for instance, draw a distinction between allowing the Roman Catholic Church to operate, because that's a worldwide organization, but they weren't concerned about, you know, Bush Baptist, you know, wanting to seed a house church, because that's a couple of people talking about the afterlife. What they've done subsequently is they've started to see any challenge. So that includes your, you know, as I say, your Bush Baptist house church. That starts to go out. And I think that under Xi, China's become a much more bombastic, militaristic place. It's no longer about getting rich and the good life. I mean, they've mentioned wokeness. I wonder, you know, who would survive the catcalling if an American state government wanted to, you know, make boys masculine in its lesson plan. And that is now the official Chinese line. They don't want effeminate boys. I think that for a lot of the social justice types, it's it's almost purely a consequence of seeing things through the lens of race. And you say, well, Chinese, you know, they're not white, therefore they, you know, part of humanity's global wretched of the earth or whatever, and therefore, you know, we must respect their culture. And this is fortified then by the stances that companies, institutions have brought into. That the NBA can be in America can be very, very uptight about racism in America, but they cracked. But none of their players were able to say anything about Hong Kong, for instance, because there's like $10 billion worth of business in China every year. It's the number I heard. Hollywood does not make movies that show China in a bad light anymore. In fact, I don't know if you've seen Pixels, you know, the one where the like video games come and eat up the world. There was apparently a scene in the original cut which showed these like Pac-Man eating the Great Wall of China. So, you know, just for funny, you know, zany comedy. But that was taken out because that might offend the Chinese. So, you know, you can have the Eiffel Tower going or, you know, Sydney Opera House, but not, hey, but, you know, don't do that to China. So fundamentally, I mean, China has been able to structure this kind of engagement on its own terms. One thing I think they've done very, very carefully is they have understood, they have learned about their opponents when their opponents have refused to learn about them. How, you know, I've often said this. I imagine every Chinese diplomat in the embassy here can speak reasonably fluent English. I wonder how many South African diplomats, and South Africa has its nose so far up China's that it has to be Pinocchio. I wonder if there is a single diplomat in our diplomatic corps who's fluent in Chinese.
I think there might be one, and I think I've met him. But I wouldn't be surprised if it's not any more than that. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you very much for watching. We hope you have a wonderful week, and we shall see you next week with the Daily French Show. Cheers, everyone.